That is the one thing that Golden State has not seen yet. They've dealt with big-time scorers, right? Damian Lillard, CJ McCollum, James Harden, Kevin Durant, Russell Westbrook. I think of all those guys I just named, Westbrook is the best playmaker. Westbrook does not have LeBron's vision, right? He doesn't have LeBron's decision-making ability or his experience in big moments. So I think the hardest test for Golden State in this series is going to be containing LeBron's playmaking ability for others, reacting to it, making sure that all of their I's are dotted and their T's are crossed when it comes to the perimeter defense stuff. I think that's going to have to be their number one focus for this series.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of Open Floor. I'm Andrew Sharp, and on the other line we've got Ben Golliver. Ben, how's it going, man?
So good, Andrew. We've got our finals matchup, and I've got to hear all about the Z-Kent.
Well, first of all, where are you right now?
I am in Oakland. Thankfully, don't have to make the quick flight to Cleveland because the Thunder collapsed in somewhat epic fashion from a 3-1 lead. So we're hanging out here until game one on Thursday.
So we could have met up in Cleveland in person, though.
Well, we still can, right?
Are you coming next week?
Sure am.
That's fantastic. Well, pod in person, break new ground for the Open Floor podcast. That's awesome.
Well, I did podcast with Rob Mahoney in the least glamorous conference room at the Courtyard Oklahoma City Airport that you've ever seen. There was a whiteboard. There was a Sharpie. It was a lot.
Just living the dream on Memorial Day weekend. Yeah, man, here we are. We made it. I cannot believe how good that series was. I'm still sort of processing things. What was your reaction to last night?
Well, I spent the last 5 minutes of the game desperately trying to delete that podcast where I said I trusted Russell Westbrook and Kevin Durant more than the Warriors stars. I was running around trying to destroy the tapes, trying to get the Watergate guys involved. Didn't work. I thought the whole series came down to game six, didn't it?
Yeah, I think the game to steal, the game that could have won the series, was game five. And then, once the Warriors had life, even in game six, I was like, even when the Thunder were up seven, I still had confidence in the Warriors, in the fourth quarter.
So here's my question. You know, Joe Lacob obviously rubbed the basketball gods a complete wrong way with the light years ahead comment. And they were ready to punish the Warriors. I think the basketball guys were right there ready to do them in because of the turnovers, because of kind of the shaky defense up and down, because of Draymond Green's restless leg syndrome, all of the factors we've discussed earlier. But did Russell Westbrook steal the bad karma from Joe Lacob by laughing at Steph Curry's defense?
I think so. There were a lot of things that went wrong in this series for the Thunder down the stretch. But as soon as Russ was cracking up at Steph's defense, and then Durant chimed in with the sort of diplomatic, but still just disrespectful enough to let everyone know that he's not that impressed with Steph. As soon as that happened, man, I started to wonder, because like I said on the last podcast, by the way, here's where I gloat. I was completely right about the way this was going to play out. Things just shift. And you look back at when the Heat were mocking Dirk's cough. Like, I don't know. The strange things happen in playoff series, man.
Well, what was kind of funny was that, you know, Durant definitely was digging at Curry by saying, you know, you hide him off the ball and, you know, he doesn't have to take the big responsibilities. So what I loved in game seven was Curry coming back and being like, oh, I hide off the ball. Well, how about I hit a 3-pointer over every single player on your team, one by one by one, completely indiscriminately, just to let you know that you can hide wherever you want on the court. Doesn't matter. I'm coming back at you.
He really did go like right down the roster. For the first half, he was kind of torturing Steven Adams. And then he went after Russ. He went after Durant on what is probably kind of the defining highlight of the series. And it was the old Steph, which was actually the craziest part of this series to me was that we watched Curry. I mean, for those couple of games in the middle when everybody sort of thought he was hurt, they couldn't figure out what was going on with him. We watched him turn into 2011 Finals LeBron, and then we watched him get it back, which was just wild.
Is it fair to say that he punked Westbrook? I think he punked Westbrook.
Oh, definitely. Definitely down the stretch. Are you kidding me? I mean, it was more respectful than Russ punking Steph would have been. But I mean, it's hard to argue that the end of the series, there's no question who's the best player.
Oh, man, it was Game 6 and 7 were unbelievable. And I thought, you know, before Game 7, I turned the guy sitting next to me on Media Row. And I just said, look, Klay kind of softened them up in Game 6 and Steph's coming for the knockout in Game 7. And he kind of waited on it. And Steph really is patient, not only within games, but within series, you know, kind of waiting for crunch time, waiting for sort of, you know, to kind of find out when he feels like the other team is going to break. And then as soon as he senses it, he just goes for it. And I thought, you know, all of the pressing that Kevin Durant was doing late in this series, you know, Steph was like the exact opposite. He just, you know, couldn't do it any better than he did. I mean, just the right amount of takeover on possessions when he needed to, you know, smart decisions in terms of clock management late where he's milking some time, the very cheeky ability to get the three foul shots on Ibaka, which, you know, Durant ultimately called the dagger. I mean, it was just really a tour de force performance down the stretch from Steph Curry in clutch time. And what an absolute contrast to his earlier play early in the series when he's throwing the ball all over the court and looks totally out of it.
Yeah, no, I mean, it was like tale of two series with the last couple of games. And I mean, so let's go back to Game 6. First of all, I'm insanely jealous that you were there and in the building for that. I mean, do you think OKC choked? That's been kind of the hot take debate over the last couple of days.
Here's how I'm going to parse it, Andrew. I don't think that they choked away the 3-1 lead. I think they choked in the final 5 minutes of Game 6. I'll put it that way. I'll just come out and say it. I mean, you look at how many turnovers they had. You look at the failure to get good shots. You look at Oklahoma City, you know, basically losing those 5 minutes 19-5. You look at no points in the final 2 minutes. You look at Westbrook just lofting up dead ducks on inbounds passes. You know, Iguodala stripping both of them clean on critical situations.
Yeah.
And then Klay Thompson just shoving it down their throat, shot after shot after shot. I don't think that it was like this epic collapse where they got in their heads after Game 4 and fell apart. I do think as soon as they got close enough to taste the finals, they fell apart completely, and they have to own that. And I think it's going to stick with them all off season and into next season.
It's really tough. Yeah. Well, first of all, before we go any further, I should go big picture. I've been a bad host today. Sorry. It was a long weekend. I was in Seattle on the bachelor party and, just filed a big column. So I'm kind of all over the place right now, but for this pod, we'll spend the first 20 minutes or so on OKC Warriors and reliving that. And then, for the last 30 minutes, we'll talk finals and dive in there. But yes, so, and not paying attention to the rest of the league because we're in it now, man. We gotta dive in. So as far as OKC choking, I completely agree with you that down the stretch, there was a lot of talk about Iguodala's defense, which was deserved. Like he was unbelievable. Obviously Klay and Steph in those final 5 minutes stepped up huge, to sort of help them along. And he was there in ways that he wasn't in Game 4 when Klay went off. And I think that was a huge difference, but yeah, I mean, as good as Iguodala's defense was, like that's where you expect Durant or Russ to step up, and they just couldn't do it.
Yeah, and it was before that too, I thought. I mean, the time to kill the Warriors in that game was the first half when Durant's coming out smoking, taking every shot that's available to him.
And I
loved it too. It was exactly the right mentality, but he just couldn't hit those shots. And actually, Steph said it after Game 7 when he's kind of basking in the glow of the comeback. He said the turning point for the whole series was the second quarter of Game 6 because they were able to kind of keep contact with the Thunder instead of getting run off the court like they did in Games 3 and 4. And I think it's a great read on it. And that goes back to Durant, but also Westbrook. Like I said, I really do think these last couple games, he just got absolutely punked. I mean, I don't know where he went. I thought he had a very strong series earlier. I thought he fell off a bit late in the series defensively. You know, he reverted
defense.
To
defense. Do we want to talk about Russ's defense?
Well, yeah, and I mean, there's that, but I mean, also his offense too. He just reverted to all of the things that people knock on him at the worst possible time. And that was why my real theme for the game six column, and I talked about this with Rob on the other podcast, so I won't belabor it, but it was just a relapse. It was everything that they've ever done wrong boiled down into one night, and it started with the Stars.
Yeah, I agree. I kind of frame it a little bit differently though, whereas if anyone was choking in this series, I think it was actually Golden State through the middle of the series, because Draymond was all over the place. Steph was in his own head and wasn't the same player, and they were totally out of sync. And then what happened from there is basically the Warriors came out and were so good that they forced OKC into the same habits they've always had. And ultimately, those first four games were less OKC becoming a whole different team and more they were so dominant that they didn't have to produce in the half court the way in crunch time, because they were just honestly running the Warriors off the court. So I guess that's kind of like a cheating answer, but I kind of just feel like that if anyone was choking, it was more Golden State. And once they got it together, OKC, the same problems that have hurt OKC all along became more relevant.
Yeah, this is super media kind of like criticism or meta criticism, whatever you want to call it. But yeah, I can't remember the last series where people argued over credit versus blame. Right. As much as they did in this series, right? Like early in the series, it was like, do you credit the Thunder's defense or the Warriors just playing terribly? And then it flipped in the second half, like you just explained. So I think that probably says it's a little bit of both. But I think just judging from the body language of Durant and Westbrook after those game six and game seven, I don't think that they feel in their deepest heart of hearts, like in their soul, that it was just the Warriors being better than them, if that makes sense. I feel like they realize they let us, something slip. You know,
we're digging into souls on the pod here. That's how you know it's playoff time. Shit's getting real.
I mean, they couldn't make eye contact a lot during those press conferences. Just the slumps.
Yeah, it was uncomfortable.
All of the confidence that was there after game five, you know, the laughing and like we talked about earlier, was all completely gone. And this was what they had played their entire season for. This is what they had kind of talked themselves into being, this team that could kind of withstand any adversity that came their way. And when the real adversity hit, they fell apart completely.
Yeah, I think that's definitely the difference in the series, is that basically the Warriors hit all kinds of adversity and were able to come back even better. And then whether, you look at Clay, you look at Bogut, you look at Iggy, I'm still not sure how to feel about Draymond after this series, to be honest. But and then Steph obviously was unreal over the past two games or so. Whereas, yeah, OKC didn't really have an answer. And I think that was the series.
I think the one number one player I gained respect for in this series was Clay. I mean,
I was going to just ask you, have you ever seen a better single playoff game, let's say, than Clay?
Oh, like, yeah. I mean, I was at LeBron Celtics 2012. So I think I'd put that game six. I think I'd put that in that category. There's been some other really good ones, but Clay's right up there. I mean, it was ridiculous.
That's kind of the way I feel about it, is it's basically like there's a certain level where it's hard to choose between one or the other. And Clay, to me, is as good as it gets. I mean, yeah, LeBron in game six against the Celtics was huge, but the shots that Clay was hitting the other night were just out of this world. And that's sort of the gold standard, basically, where you wake up the next day and you're like, holy shit, was that real?
Oh, totally. And I just loved his demeanor. And you know what's part of it is, I wonder if that game would have been even better if he was more expressive, right? Because like, what do we remember from game seven? Is Steph putting his jersey in his mouth, right? Like, what do we remember from like LeBron's greatest moments, when he has those meltdowns where he's like, wow, he's like screaming and the crowd's into it. And it's like, Clay is such a silent assassin. He carries himself so steadily, basically at all times. And he's so unimpressed with his own ability. I mean, in the press conference afterwards, he's talking about how he thought he could have had 13 in threes instead of 11. You know, like, he's just matter of fact and so flat. I wonder if that almost takes away from him. It's almost like he needs an image consultant to be like, hey, Clay, like, we know you don't have emotions, but like after you hit like the seventh dagger three of a game, like pump your fist or like do something so that, you know, you might make the SportsCenter highlight reels 10 years from now.
Yeah, I wonder if he would be a bigger star right now if he had more of a personality. I kind of enjoy him being just like a blank slate, but I wonder.
No, I like that he stays true to himself. You know, there's nothing fake about him. And what a timely performance. He really carried Steph. I mean, I think Steph owes him. And I think a big takeaway from the West Finals, especially after last night, was just the perspective that the Warriors gained by kind of staring death in the face a little bit here in this series. And I think Steph was incredibly appreciative of the opportunity to go back to the finals. I mean, he repeated that a couple of times. And I think a big part of that for him is that he knows Clay saved his bacon, right?
Funny Clay Thompson story. I was at an all-star party a couple years ago, and I saw Clay leaned up against a wall talking to, like, there were a bunch of models there, and he was talking to one of them. And I sort of leaned in and overheard what they were talking about. And Clay was talking to this girl about his dogs or his dog and taking his dog to the park and all that stuff. And I walked away being like, this either means that Clay Thompson has absolutely no game or like next level game. Because once, I mean, if you're talking about the dog, like that's hard for any woman to resist. So I was sort of, it lived up to all my Clay Thompson expectations.
I think he just needs to show girls his true shooting percentage numbers. I think that's.
I don't know, man. I don't know if they can resist the dog and the true shooting percentage. Yeah.
I think that's game, set, match.
He's either very boring or much cooler than any of us realize. I think that's the point of that story.
Well, I think he's much cooler than we realize. I think that's pretty obvious. No question. If not, you know, just Google like Clay Thompson Instagram model and you'll be fully convinced.
Of course. Hannah Stocking.
There you go.
Yeah. It's pretty fantastic. He's not Tim Duncan, even though he seems like it. So what else is stuck with you after this series?
Well, what you said about Draymond, I think, was a good point for sure. I think he's pulled out of the slump, though. I think we can agree with that. I mean, the lowest of the lows were games 3 and 4. I thought game 5, he made a big impact defensively. And then, you know, he started to do a little bit more in transition in game 6 and 7. It didn't always go right, but at least he started to look more like himself a little bit. Right. And I think that bodes very well for Golden State entering the finals, because I think when you look at the matchups, and we could talk about this, I guess, in depth if you want, but I think the matchups in the finals really favor the Warriors. And I think Draymond's going to be in position where now that he doesn't have to deal with Kevin Durant kind of stalking him all over the court, he's going to be in a position to have a really big series.
Yeah, I agree. Or at least I'm curious, because I really think that one of the reasons the Thunder are such a bad matchup for the Warriors is because they're such a bad matchup for Draymond, and all that length is like the one weakness that isn't going to go away with him. And it's going to be an issue against Giannis. It's going to be an issue against the Thunder. It's going to be sort of the one thing that they can't deal with. And maybe the Wolves with Karl Towns one day. But Cleveland doesn't have that. And if you put Draymond against Kevin Love, I mean, they're going to need LeBron to sort of be his foil, don't you think?
Well, I just love how your finals prediction is Bucks in 6.
No. One day, man. One day. I've been riding with the Bucks for several years now.
No, I can really tell. No, that's funny. Well, so what you say about LeBron having to guard Draymond, is that what you said?
Well, yeah.
Yeah, no, I think that's probably going to be how it goes. I think you're going to see lots of small ball in the finals, and I think that's a recipe for disaster for Cleveland, because you know, I kind of look at this like, you know, big picture, the Thunder were the test that the Warriors needed, right? All the complacency and carelessness that we talked about, I think they kind of worked that out of their system, right?
That's why I liked this series, by the way, because it forced the Warriors to go to a level that we hadn't really seen all year, because they've just been better than everybody. And this was like a psychological and physical test that sort of cemented the legend a little bit.
100%. And it was exactly what they needed. And if you flip it and you say, okay, that's the perfect preparation for a finals against the Cavaliers, who are going to be a much better team than the Cavs were last year in the finals. But then you flip that and you say, okay, well, what kind of preparation did the Cavaliers have for the Warriors? And then you just say the names Kyle Lowry, DeMar DeRozan, and you look at their shooting numbers, and then you just start laughing.
You know what else I was thinking of? One of the things that I enjoyed most about this Thunder Warriors series, and especially down the stretch, was watching Steph when he would get switched on to big, or when big men would switch on to him off of pick and rolls. It was just, it's like he hits like another level of confidence. Especially, I first noticed it when Enes Kanter would get switched onto him, because then you could watch him move and he would look up and see Kanter, and it was like, well, this is going up and it's probably going in. And then, and it sort of got lost there during the middle of the series, where he was more unsure of himself on those switches than we'd ever seen. But then last night, I mean, some of the Steven Adams switches, like, I started to feel bad. And that's Steven Adams, who is quicker and bigger than almost any big man in the league, and is better equipped to handle those switches than anyone. So to bring this around to Cleveland, I mean, I don't know if Kevin Love is going to survive this series. And then even guys like Channing Frye, who's been fantastic. Like, what do you do if like it's Channing Frye and Steph Curry on an island 25 feet from the hoop?
Yeah, no, I think Steph looks like he's basically making a spider web around these big guys when he gets switched out onto
it's
him.
It's like his eyes get bigger, right?
Yeah. And then he just kind of lulls them and eventually goes in for the kill. It's beautiful. And that's why he did look like he was finally back to normal. And Steve Kerr kind of hinted like, oh, you know, Steph's finally back. He's finally feeling right. And he said that after game 7, it's like, Steve, we've been asking you for 4 games whether Steph's hurt or not. And you keep saying no, no, no. And now you're telling us that he's back right physically. Okay, well, having some level of comfort or rhythm that he didn't have earlier in the series probably owes at least somewhat to where Steph's at kind of, physically, health wise. Mm-hmm. And I definitely thought in game 1, when he wasn't, taking advantage of those situations, there must have been something wrong. And I'm glad to see that those questions probably are to the side and kind of answered as we go into the finals, because he has a position, he's in position to just, torture Dellavedova like he did late in the last year's finals. And then also, like you're saying, really potentially play Kevin Love off the court, and then also take advantage of a defense in Cleveland that is not nearly as long or imposing as the Thunder were. And that's why I think these matchups are so favorable, because if you look at for the Warriors, if you look at Steph, I mean, Cleveland doesn't have a very good answer for him, and certainly not as good of an answer as the Thunder did.
Well, for the record, I'm not conceding anything. I'm Team Dellavedova, and he turns basketball into mixed martial arts, and I could absolutely see him throwing Steph off for a few games.
Okay, that's fine. But we're talking about, are they going to pull the upset, I guess, is what I'm looking at.
Because before we get that far, let's save that for the second half of the pod. Last thoughts on OKC, because we're going to be diving into the finals. What's the future look like to you now? And do you think this is something that we'll look back on in like 5 years and be like, hey, that was their shot?
That was a very good shot for them, but I think the fact that they can bring everybody back next year, assuming KD recommits, and I think all indications are at this point that he will. I mean, just how he was trying to console everybody, on the way off the court, kind of, telling guys like Dion Waiters, kind of trying to keep their heads up. Just his general, inclusiveness in terms of his comments, talking about the Thunder, and sort of looking forward to their future, and rather than distancing himself. And then also just how far they made it in this series. I think that all kind of points to him coming back. And I think as long as he's back, they're going to have another really good run next year. There's nothing really financially standing in the way of that happening, as long as ownership's willing to kind of fork up the money, because their roster is pretty expensive. So to me, they're going to have another shot next year. They're going to be in position. You could probably make the argument San Antonio is going to take a step back next year, based on, who might retire and age and things like that. So I don't see why can't we have Thunder Warriors again in the Western Conference Finals next year? I don't see what's standing in the way of that.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I think if KD comes back, this is going to be another epic war next year. But you don't think that it's opened the door at all for him to leave?
No, no.
I mean, I'm like Mr. Tinfoil Hat with this shit. So
no, definitely not.
I have to guard against that. But I don't know. I mean, here's the thing. The Russ issues are not like it. This has happened for several years now.
But he didn't really seem that frustrated by it, right? And I think he was the one who was riding with Russ more than almost anybody.
I know. I think it's I'm speaking as someone who wants great things for Durant, and it may just be time to sort of try something new somewhere.
Just being in Oklahoma City, seeing how they embrace him in general, I don't know if you saw my column, there was one fan who said, you know, it was Kevin's fault.
It was more than one fan saying it was Kevin's fault.
That's very true. But at the same time, what's a better situation for him next year? I mean, a better realist. There's no way in hell he's going to, you know, clown Curry on the podium and then go sign with the Warriors. I don't see that happening. Yeah,
Want him going to the Spurs. But what if he went to the Clippers?
That's not a better situation.
You don't think Chris Paul, DeAndre Jordan, with a changed hacking rule, which makes DeAndre a lot more valuable and someone you can keep on the court in the fourth quarters of playoff games. You don't think that's a better situation?
Nope. Because ultimately Kevin has to live with himself, you know, and he's a very loyal guy, and he just, you know, if you want to blame it on him, fine. He probably blames himself too. Right. So he just let a 3-1 lead go with a chance to go to the finals. He did it with a roster that was kind of constructed around him. He did it with people that he's been surrounded with for year after year after year. He's going to just say goodbye to all of that to go roll with Doc Rivers and Chris Paul.
I'm just playing devil's advocate for the most part.
I think it. I'm just saying, like, that's a tough sell. That's a really tough sell.
Yeah. Well, and another factor that has really changed this conversation is Steven Adams and what he's done over the past month. He really shifts the whole future here because he's only going to get better. I looked today, he's 22 years old, which is actually even younger than I thought. And, it's definitely very difficult to leave him, but I just think that there's stuff that goes into this calculus that, that goes beyond just next season. And it comes down to, I mean, I don't know how much longer Russ can play at this level, whereas I think Durant has another 6 or 7 years of just elite basketball. But physically, Westbrook's definitely going to start breaking down soon, don't you think?
Well, I think if the question becomes, are both Durant and Westbrook going to be there for the next 5 years, I would be more dubious, right? I could see a situation where Westbrook leaves. I could see a situation where KD takes a short contract and does kind of hit that breaking point where enough is enough and he decides he has to part ways. I could see almost any of those scenarios long term. But if we're talking about just this summer, do I see Kevin leaving? I just don't see it. I don't think that he leaves this series with the kind of frustration that says, I need to bounce. I think he leaves it frustrated at his own play, the fact that he couldn't close the door, the fact that a lot of those issues popped back up, you know, late in game six. And also the fact that they lost to the golden boy who gets all the attention, Steph Curry, and that they didn't have an answer for him. I think those are the sources of frustration. And I still think that they leave with the confidence that they were right there with those guys in the series in Billy Donovan's first year, and they should be back even stronger next season.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. You've convinced me. You've talked me off out of conspiracy corner. Because it makes so much financial sense to stay another year and then have the opportunity to go anywhere and get like a huge payday next summer. And he could still make a lot of money if he left this summer, but it would take some creative contracts over the next few years to really max things out. But I do think that, the way this series ended may open up the possibility, at least, to where he'll talk to a couple teams like Boston. He'll talk to DC, even though I think that's solidly at 1%. And who knows, Miami, LA, there are a lot of LA Clippers, LA Lakers. There are a lot of different things that can happen. And a week ago, if we had had this conversation, it would have been like, no way in hell Durant leaves. And now I think it's still... far more likely that he'll stay now than it was a couple months ago. But and especially after this playoff run, like you said. But I don't know, man. It's not a 0% chance is all I'm saying.
I hear you. And I think he should take those meetings, you know, and put the pressure on the Thunder to spend the money. I mean, it's sort of the LeBron leverage angle, right? Like every year he's a free agent so that, you know, it kind of forces Dan Gilbert to always, you know, recommit to spending on the supporting cast. And I think that's exactly how KD should play it, too. Go meet with everybody. Go meet with the Lakers just so he can get an extra 50,000 Twitter followers. You know, I mean, see everybody. And let Clay Bennett and company know, like, these guys are in their window right now. They need to spend whatever it takes, luxury tax, et cetera, to, you know, keep this group together, to bring back guy like Waiters, whoever else it might be that they want to keep, to kind of give them the best shot to win. But and ultimately, I think that stuff is going to be more posturing as opposed to sort of real interest.
Okay. Last OKC question. How was the Banjo Museum? You finally made it.
Oh, I got so many stories about freaking Oklahoma City. Good Lord. So, yeah, I went to the Banjo Museum. I was the only person there under 50, Andrew.
I loved it. I got a text like Sunday night, and it was just you smiling in front of the Banjo Museum. Probably the best text message I got all weekend.
Yeah, no, it was the greatest text message I've ever sent. It was the happiest thing I've ever.
Just living your dreams.
So I get there. And you're immediately greeted by just a 6.5-foot tall cardboard cutout of Steve Martin. So it's just right off the top.
What?
Yeah. Apparently he's a big.
Did you investigate? Does Steve Martin have Oklahoma City ties?
No, he's the banjo man, dude. He loves the banjo. Like he's like really repping hard to keep the banjo alive in American culture, apparently. And he was
Holy
actually
shit. I had no idea.
He was
a
actually
big Steve Martin fan. He's great.
You know, he was actually inducted into the Banjo Hall of Fame. So you'll be very happy to know.
All right. Is the Banjo Museum or is the Banjo Hall of Fame outside of Oklahoma City?
I couldn't quite tell if it was the same thing, but they had they had Hall of Fame plaques there. I mean, this thing was out of control, Andrew. So they had an entire, like basically a banjo club from like the 1930s. They had that in, like in the upstairs, right? So like they had reconfigured this banjo, you know, like nightclub. And so they had all these signs like from the time. And one of the bands was called the G-String Strugglers. That was my favorite. Probably a different meaning here in 2016 than in 1930. But they had, you know, like a little platform where they would have performed. They had the music going. It was pretty wild. They had hundreds of banjos, many of them with like American regalia, you know, lots of bald eagles and other outside, or, you know, like animals. Imagery.
Animals love the banjo. Everybody knows bald eagles.
They had actually like, I don't know if it was sort of like southern plantations or whatever, but they had like recreated where, you know, porches where people had played the banjo. They had all this information about how the 5-string banjo was the original banjo, like the retro banjo. But then they had to come through with the 4-stringer so it could be louder once the jazz age hit. I mean, there was a lot of information. There was a lot. I learned a lot, Andrew.
It's like stepping into a Wikipedia article.
And on top of that, the lady was like so, I mean, she could sense my enthusiasm. Like she's probably 55. You know, I might have been the only person literally under 50 who went to that thing all day. And she could really sense how excited I was because I was taking pictures of literally everything.
I was going to say, so you do a playoff diary full of just random sights and sounds from the road, right?
Yeah, this year it's just going to be 50 pictures from the Banjo Museum.
Yeah, it's all Oklahoma City. Banjo Museum, Cracker Barrel, the Boot Barn, just like all the greatest hits from OKC.
So there was like a VIP room and she's like, you know, we actually have banjos back here that you can play if you want. But I choked. I pulled a Westbrook and I couldn't do it. I didn't want to break any of the banjos, which I got the invite to the VIP room.
Oh man, that's the Banjo Museum has a VIP room. Holy shit. How could Kevin Durant ever leave Oklahoma City?
You heard it here first. He's locking up 5-year contract.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
Wait, I have one more for you though. So I'm trying to leave Oklahoma City, right? I'm at the airport. I'm getting on the plane. And Michael Lee of the Vertical is like sitting like two rows in front of me on the plane. And, you know, we're flying to Los Angeles en route to San Francisco.
Uh-huh.
And everything's going just fine. And all of a sudden the pilot comes on the intercom and he goes, "All right, guys, we need to deplane the aircraft. The lavatory is leaking blue hazardous material and it's covered the final three rows of this airplane. The plane is no longer operational or safe to use." And then he like really dramatically pauses and he goes, "Look, we're not going to try to point fingers at anybody right now. That's not helpful, but we just need everybody off the aircraft." And Michael Lee turns around and gives me like the bug eye emoji, like in human form.
Yeah.
Like, what did he just say? And I was just, I like shook my head and I was like, all bad. Just all bad.
Well, so it was probably Michael Lee's fault. That's why he was pretending to be shocked.
It was not Michael Lee's fault.
No, I've taken some plane rides with Michael Lee. He's great. But I've also never been on a plane. I've never had one of those like crazy plane stories. So I'm a little bit jealous, actually.
Hazardous material exploding out of the lavatory.
Yeah, no, that blue stuff is disgusting. It's like, I'm glad you got to get off the plane before that happened in the air. Look at it that way.
Yeah, so I've been growing a third arm over the last couple of days.
Yeah, I was gonna say,
could be related. Signs. Could be related. Could be not.
These are the sacrifices that we make to be on the road covering the playoffs. God knows what's gonna happen in Cleveland too.
Oh, yeah. People think it's real glamorous, right? Not glamorous at all. Hey,
there's hazardous material everywhere.
Well, let me flip this back on you, though, because, you know, you said that we were done talking about Oklahoma City, but we're not really done talking about Oklahoma City because we need to talk about the Seattle angle and how did it go up there?
Oh, man. Yeah. There was actually an article in the Wall Street Journal today about Seattle fans and how much they still hate the Thunder. And Chris Herring wrote it. I watched, and so you should check that out, but I watched with a bunch of Seattle fans who, I mean, they hate the Thunder. It's like, and it's kind of refreshing because in our sort of media bubble, you get a lot of people who, I mean, I like most of the teams, to be honest with you. And at this point, like, there are things I like and dislike about everybody, but this is more like a college football relationship, where no matter what happens, Seattle fans just want pain with OKC. And so watching Saturday night,
maybe death, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was bad. Watching Saturday night for 3.5 quarters, it was sort of like uncomfortable silence with a bunch of people watching the Thunder just come through over and over again. And then when Clay and Steph really went off and the Warriors took the lead, it was a lot of fun. I wanted a game seven at least. And as I said, I had sort of predicted the Warriors comeback. So I was riding the Golden State bandwagon. And, you know, I think more than anything, Seattle needs a team so that we can sort of dispel a little bit of this hate. It's not healthy.
Well, I think the way we should dispel the hate is by you telling us exactly the kinds of things that people were saying.
There's a lot of shit. There's a lot of stuff about Clay Bennett that I really can't repeat.
Oh boy. Well, so do they, is it the organization or do they hold stuff against the players? Like, cause there's a loyalty factor to KD though, right?
There is. I mean, KD loved Seattle when he was there, apparently. And so there, it's less personal with the players. But where I mean, I've never liked the Thunder management and have always still rooted for the players. And that's not true for anyone in Seattle. They're kind of like, we don't have a specific beef with KD or Russ, but we still want them to go down in flames every single playoffs. And that's kind of what happened, you know?
Gotcha. Well, that's interesting. So, was it like they were celebrating when the game was over? It was like the Sonics had won, basically. Like, it was that level. Oh,
definitely. Definitely. There's a lot of sort of championship feel to it, which was great. And then we had the Zeke end, and I got to go out to Tacoma featuring luminaries like Isaiah Thomas and Jared Sullinger. And Ben McLemore.
Wow.
Yeah. And so I was there with friends who who knew a couple other people, like Evan Turner was there. I said what up to him, and Spencer Hawes, who's a Seattle sort of hoops luminary, and is also a friend of mine. So I got to bullshit with those guys, and it was fun. But the Zeekend, I have to tell you, the t-shirts were fantastic. The actual basketball, not as great.
Yeah, there's a little drop off from like high level Western Conference
from
finals
Thunder Warriors to Ben McLemore in like a rec league situation.
Yeah, it's funny how that works out. I'm just trying to think now, do you think that Steve Martin is bigger for the banjo community or Spencer Hawes for the Seattle community? It's like 50-50. I mean, it's really close.
Spence is repping pretty hard for Seattle. So I honestly haven't studied enough of Steve Martin's banjo enthusiasm to really comment.
Okay, so who won? Like, what was there, a champion, or how did it go?
You know, that's one of the things I couldn't really figure out whether it was like a tournament or something. We stayed through two games, and Isaiah Thomas's team won. And Isaiah was sort of like a player coach. He would play for 3 minutes and then just coach on the sidelines. And but Ben McLemore got a lot of run. I think he still has something to prove. So he was on the level where like you still play in the games. You're not a real star yet.
So the big takeaway, though, from the bachelor party weekend is that you're still going to get married, right?
I'm still going to get married. Yeah.
Fantastic. So it was a perfect weekend.
My head is a little hazy today, so just bear with me on the pod here.
But that's all that matters. As long as you didn't jeopardize the marriage, and as long as, you know, you didn't get into a political debate with Spencer Hawes, you're probably good.
Yeah, we're all set. It was a great weekend. Seattle is my favorite city in the country. So I honestly just want a basketball team back there so that I can move there.
Yeah, it would be great. That was my lingering feeling for, you know, a solid 5 years there when I was in Portland. It's like, wow, it'd be awesome if there was another team that we could just drive up to at any given moment. And we kept waiting and waiting and waiting and just never came up. And I guess they recently had a big political beef over not being able to get a stadium. And it got really ugly with the local city council. So,
yeah, you know what we need to do is we need to just move the Sacramento Kings to Seattle. Remove them from Vivek's grasp. And I know they just got a new stadium. I don't care. Get the Kings to Seattle. Seattle's a much cooler city than Sacramento.
You know, we shouldn't even be joking about that because the Kings fans, you know, they've been on edge for a while, and rightfully so. Like, they don't deserve that.
I take back nothing. Give the Kings to Seattle. All right. So what do you think, man? Finals, let's do 15 minutes. I honestly haven't really thought too much about like the individual matchups, but what are the factors that you're looking at just off your gut after we've all survived Thunder Warriors?
Well, I just think that, and we talked about the preparation factor, but when you just look at the matchups, like number one, just real quick, like defending Kyrie Irving, very similar to defending Russell Westbrook, defending Kevin Love, you know, pretty similar to dealing with guys like Serge Ibaka in terms of the offensive role, you know, spreading and shooting lots of threes. You know, handling LeBron James is something that the Warriors have done before in the finals. And then it's also, you know, fairly similar to, you know, dealing with, you know, Kevin Durant in terms of throwing multiple defenders at him, trying to change up your schemes, just make him guess, make him work for everything. And then, you know, from that standpoint, I think the Warriors got like the perfect training course to try to defend those guys in the Western Conference Finals. And when you flip it for Cleveland, they haven't seen anything like Steph Curry. They haven't seen anything like Klay Thompson, and they haven't seen anything like Draymond Green in this postseason whatsoever. So I kind of feel like the Warriors are going from already being in sixth gear to just kind of keeping sixth gear going, whereas the Cavaliers are going to have to shift from basically third or fourth up to sixth. And I just not sure, you know, I know that they've played very cohesive basketball. They've done a great job passing the ball. LeBron's been a phenomenal distributor. They've been getting lots of support from a pretty quality bench unit. But I just wonder if all those things are really going to hold up, and are Kyrie and Kevin Love going to be able to be big time impact makers against a team that's on Golden State's level. And I'm just very dubious of a lot of those things.
That's interesting that you say the sixth gear thing, because I kind of come at it a little bit differently, where I look at, yes, the Warriors just had to get into sixth gear and really, really fight their ass off to beat the Thunder. And that, it was incredible to watch. But I also think that one of the reasons the Eastern Conference playoffs have been so awful is that the Cavs did find the sixth gear. And once you put that team, once you get that team clicking on all cylinders, I mean, no one in the East has a prayer. And the Hawks series is a better example than the Raptors. The Raptors, I do think they sort of hit a lull for a little while. Obviously, they lost those two games. But the Hawks, I mean, that was a that Hawks team is actually a pretty good team. And they were just they were blown off the floor, not only because the Cavs got hot, but also because they were running their offense better than they have all year and were getting wide open looks. I mean, that's the thing that I think a lot of people miss when they talk about what this Cavs team has been doing, is like those guys, it's not just a fluke that the threes are going in. It's because they're actually running the offense.
Yeah, I just think the Warriors defense
you're
is a
totally
lot.
Not sold. I love
no,
it.
No. I definitely agree that they played their best basketball of the LeBron's, you know, the second LeBron era,
right?
Their best team basketball, no question, over the last month. I mean, definitely. I just don't think that they've been challenged like the Warriors can challenge them in terms of, you know, what the Warriors can do defensively when they go small, interchange everything. They're so disciplined, and their defense has really stepped up, especially in the last couple of games here. They've locked into a different level. I guess one way I look at it is like Cleveland is swimming and setting swimming records in a lap pool, you know, against the Eastern Conference, right? But now we're throwing them into the ocean with sharks. You know, are they still going to be able to swim that fast?
I love your analogies. Yeah, I mean, I can see that. I definitely can see that. One of the other things I worry about, I'm not sure how this plays into the swimming analogy, but what about their bench?
Well, that's what I said. The bench has been great. I think the key for Cleveland to pull this upset, number one, they got to use the rest advantage to take game one, just like the Thunder did. I mean, the Thunder kind of laid the blueprint for them, right? Like hop on the Warriors early before they have a chance to adjust and just rip home court advantage out of their hands as soon as possible. And I think that's very, you know, that can happen. And then I think number two, they've got to get the equivalent of the Andre Robertson game, like game four. Like they've got to get that from some of their bench guys. And it could really be anybody. Dellavedova with the threes, Channing Frye with the threes. J.R. Smith, you know, he didn't have that big time game in last year's finals. Now that he's kind of back into being like the third, fourth or fifth guy, that sets him up to have, you know, more potential to be the X factor type offensively. That's going to be where you know, their shot at pulling the upset comes from.
Well, and additionally, though, you know, we talk about sharks in the ocean. I don't know how many sharks Golden State has coming off the bench.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, if Anderson Varejao can capture the greatest minute of his entire life from game seven and extend that for 48 minutes over seven games, they're going to be unbeatable.
Yeah, he has 90 seconds to validate like hours worth of playing time that's still pretty inexplicable.
Well, I would say Livingston. I mean, you can count on
Livingston's
him.
Great. Yeah. But I think beyond
it
that,
Iguodala for sure.
But I think, don't you feel like they might have to start Iguodala?
Well, I think if I was the
Barnes
Warriors,
has been struggling.
Yeah, he has. If I was the Warriors, I would open the series starting Barnes and just pray that he finally decides to do something, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And if that doesn't happen, you can always kind of come back with Iguodala. Also, if I was the Warriors, I would start big so you can get as many minutes as possible from Bogut, saving your smaller ball lineups sort of later in the series and later into games. And I think if you do that, then you've got eight or nine guys you're playing, and that should be able to carry you, you know, well enough. But I do think that Cleveland's bench has been playing very well. And again, this goes back to the, you know, pool versus ocean thing, like. They're beating teams that don't have, you know,
have
sort of
nothing off the bench, right?
Yeah, nothing off the bench and no experience really like doing it in the post, you know, the postseason. You know, teams like the Warriors and the Hawks, I mean, their bench guys are, you know,
you
forgettable.
Raptors. Yeah.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, the Raptors. And the Warriors have done it not only this season, but last season too, because all their bench guys are basically the same.
Yeah, I hear you. I just feel like the one thing that this series, as far as weaknesses are concerned, the one thing that the Thunder exposed is that those few minutes, each of the past few games where Kerr started with no Curry or Thompson or even Draymond, and the Warriors were really just relying on their bench. I mean, you had to sort of hang on for dear life because you got guys like, I mean, Livingston is great, but he can't score. I'm a big Most Bates guy, maybe not quite as big as some of the rest of the internet, but if you're counting on him, it's going to be dicey in a lot of these games.
Well, the one thing that Kerr kind of admitted to, I think it might've been before game seven, but it was one of these, you know, these last couple of press conferences, is that he's monitoring those lineups very, very carefully. Like his finger is on the trigger, right? So if they give up that 5-0 run or that 6-0 run, then he's opting out of those like bench heavy lineups very quickly. So I think he's really the definition of buying himself time. Like he's taking it like almost possession by possession, case by case, trying to get as much time for his main guys as possible. So I don't think there's going to be a situation where those guys are just like randomly left stranded out there for 5 minutes and Cleveland just blows them off the court. I think to a certain degree, Kerr learned his lesson about that during games 3 and 4 in Oklahoma City.
Yeah. Do you think they close with a death lineup here?
I think that the death lineup matches up better with the Cavs than it did against the Thunder. And so I think that that's going to be a big time go-to in this series. I think we saw it with the whole season on the line. You know, both teams went small in game 7 of the Western Conference Finals. And Golden State also went small in game 6 of the Western Conference Finals. So I think they're still feeling like that's their best look. And, you know, going back to your point about Kevin Love, I don't think Kevin Love can stay on the court against the death lineup.
Yeah, that's my other question is what lineup do you close with if you're Cleveland?
If I'm Cleveland, I probably am playing, you know, Tristan, LeBron, and then three wings. So it'd probably be Kyrie or three smalls, you know, so Kyrie, Dellavedova, and then probably J.R. Smith.
Here we go. Let's ride the J.R. Smith roller coaster.
And I think that that's tricky. And there could be a situation where Kyrie's not part of it. You know, he's going to have the pressure is really going to be on Kyrie to defend in this series. And he's probably going to have to defend Steph because I don't think you can put him on to
play. Yeah, definitely.
So, yeah. So that's a very tough matchup for him. And if there was a situation where, you know, one of the finals games came down to the very end and neither Kevin Love nor Kyrie was on the court, it wouldn't totally shock me.
Wow. Yeah, I don't know what's going to happen. I think that's honestly the most honest take I have, because I think coming after Thunder Warriors, where everybody looked stupid after 4 games and then everything changed after game 5 and 6. I mean, I think that's part of what I'm excited about with the finals is that it's going to take a couple games before we really know what we're dealing with, because we didn't see Cleveland. This is a totally different Cavs team than we saw last year. And if Kyrie can provide enough offense, if Channing Frye can lift a second unit, I mean, the dynamics are going to be a little different, I think.
Yeah, well, I think the thing that I'm most excited about, or the one biggest question mark that I have about this series, it's LeBron, because he's so rested, he's so confident, he's so locked in, and he doesn't have David Blatt like kind of, you know, irritating him in the background, right? Like, I think he's basically everything's built around him now for the first time during his 2 years in Cleveland, where he's comfortable with it. And so that can lead to just crazy performances, you know, just
exactly
winning 2 games by himself type performances.
And LeBron plus the bench is why I am not ready to write anything off right now.
Well, I think that's the best. I think that's the best argument Cleveland's got going for themselves. And that is the one thing that Golden State has not seen yet. They've dealt with big time scorers, right? Damian Lillard, CJ McCollum, James Harden, Kevin Durant, Russell Westbrook. I think of all those guys I just named, Westbrook is the best playmaker. Westbrook does not have LeBron's vision, right? He doesn't have LeBron's decision-making ability or his experience in big moments. So I think the hardest test for Golden State in this series is going to be, containing LeBron's playmaking ability for others, reacting to it, making sure that all of their, their I's are dotted and their T's are crossed when it comes to the perimeter defense stuff. I think that's going to have to be their number one focus for this series, much like kind of keeping Oklahoma City out of transition had to be one of their top focuses you know, in the Western Conference Finals.
Well, and then the flip side of what you're talking about with what OKC hasn't seen, I think when you look at the Cavs, they've been fantastic. And like I said, they've been in sixth gear and clicking on all cylinders, and the offense is working better than ever. But of the teams in the East, there hasn't been a single team that has a real body that they can throw at LeBron. I mean, the Heat would have had Justice Winslow and possibly Luol Deng to try and slow him down. But none of the team, the Raptors didn't really have anybody. The Hawks certainly didn't, and the Pistons didn't. And the Warriors do. Iggy slowed him down in last year's finals better than anyone I had seen. Anyway, I've seen in a long time. And Draymond can match him up too.
Yeah, and Barnes can give minutes, and Thompson can give minutes. So they've got four guys who can be used on LeBron, and maybe even Livingston in slight
Livingston's
doses.
Another one.
But I think even more important than that is they're defending the basket area, right? A lot of the teams that Cleveland basically faced in the playoffs to date really struggled to take away the rim area from LeBron. I mean, all of LeBron's shots were coming at the rim. The only guy who really gave him trouble was Biombo at the end, right? But before that, it was like just, drive,
right,
and no resistance. And Bogut and Draymond are among the best rim protectors in the NBA as a combination. They've also got Azili if they want to put him in there for length. So they've got that part mastered. And so that's going to put pressure on LeBron to make shots from the mid-range, from the post, and then also from the perimeter. And I think you're going to see Golden State just daring him to shoot this series.
Yeah, we'll see. So what's your pick? First of all, we should do these picks earlier in the podcast. I'm a little upset that I didn't make my Warriors pick at the top of last podcast so that I could get more credit.
You've mentioned it five times now. Do you want to mention this?
I'm sorry. I apologize to everyone.
Let me, for the record, I did pick Warriors in seven at the beginning of the series.
That's true.
I did change that pick seven times over the course of the series.
Well,
but
did you see the people over the weekend who were tweeting at us being like, you guys both picked the Thunder, lazy. And I was man, you clearly didn't listen to the pod.
No, I did. I don't read the Twitter mentions. Sorry to people.
Well, that's why you gotta. Any listeners, this is why you gotta stick around to 55 minutes in.
Warriors in six.
Okay.
I wanted to go five, but I'm gonna give LeBron the respect.
I would love to see the Warriors win, but I'm going Cavs in six.
Oh boy!
It feels like destiny. We've all been sleeping on LeBron all year long. I'm sorry. And there's just enough weaknesses on this Warriors team right now, whether it's Azili hasn't looked very good, Barnes hasn't looked very good, and LeBron has looked unbelievable for about the last 6 weeks.
Okay. Let's get, I need more than that to cling on to.
No, I mean, that's all I'm saying. And I've said it on this podcast for like 6 weeks ago. I said it. I just have a feeling that this is the year Cleveland gets it.
So if there's going to be an unsung hero for Cleveland, sort of like the Iguodala was for the Warriors late in the West Finals, who's going to be the guy who, LeBron brings up on the podium with him, when they're accepting the Larry O'Brien trophy afterwards, who's going to be the guy riding shotgun?
That's a good question. And the way I look at it is, J.R. Smith can't possibly play worse than he did in last year's final. So he's due to come up big in a couple of these games.
I was praying for you to say Dele.
Dele has my heart. I mean, don't get it twisted. I already predicted Dele shutting down Steph Curry for at least a couple of these games, which is insane. But I think that, and Shumpert is another guy who's we sort of haven't really talked about all year, but will be. I mean, he's another guy that they can throw at Clay and Steph. That he's not on anybody's radar, but he's a great two way option for them.
For sure. I think I might have picked him in that Cavs roundtable as sort of like an under the radar type guy for them. I think he's going to have a big series because they're just going to need him. When the Warriors are bringing three and four wings out there, they're going to need his defense. And, you know, he can stand in the corner, and if the shot's wide open, he can hit every once in a while. I mean, he's a better option doing that than a guy like Robertson. So I think that, you know, that's a pretty good pick. I don't know if he'll be for the whole series, but he might be able to help them, you know, scratch out a game here or there. Are you worried, though, that once the Warriors kind of figured out that the death lineup was so amazing in last year's finals, that the Cavaliers just still don't have an answer for that group, and that, you know, basically the 1-on-5 or 2-on-5 approach of LeBron and whoever else shows up is not going to cut it, you know, when they're, you know, hitting three after three after three, like they did in last year's finals and like they did these last two games against Oklahoma City?
Oh, definitely. Are you kidding me? It's terrifying to pick to pick against the Warriors after not only after what just happened against the Thunder, because that was a series that the Warriors really should have lost. And they, with their backs against the wall, I mean, Clay put together one of the most legendary playoff single games we've ever seen. And then Steph is now back to normal. So yeah, it's scary. And then what they've done to the Cavs this year, but that's some of those Cavs games are why I feel comfortable, because I guarantee you, it's not going to be a 30-point blowout in game one. You know what I mean? Like that was the Cavs at rock bottom. And I think that's informing the way a lot of people look at this series. And it's much closer than people realize.
I definitely agree with that. At the same time, I think as the series goes on, unless Kevin Love or Kyrie can really, like, you know, kind of stick, you know what I mean? Like play big minutes and have that star type impact. I think that, you know, the Warriors stars have such an advantage over the Cavaliers stars in terms of how they fit into their roles and how they match up, that there is blowout potential sort of as the series unfolds. But I do think, you know, looking back at the start of last year's finals, Golden State started very slow. Draymond was sloppy. Steph was a little bit shook. And so you wonder, are they going to use that experience as sort of a learning experience? And now they're going to come in game one a little bit better focused this time, because it's not the first time they dealt with all the lights. Or do they kind of lean on that as, okay, well, you know, we can figure it out down the road. Let's just kind of get our feet wet here early.
That's my biggest fear, is that the way to beat the Warriors, you need them to be a little bit shook. And it happened in this Thunder series. It happened in last year's finals. And right now, after going to the brink and then coming back and you know, putting together what they just did, the Warriors are now feeling better than ever. And I can't imagine that they're feeling a whole lot of fear going into these first two games.
I agree. I think that that was the test they need. I keep repeating that over and over, but like the Thunder worked them in so many different ways that they needed. And I think that if I'm the Warriors, I'm probably happier playing the Cavs, more comfortable playing the Cavs than I was playing the Thunder, just because of the matchup issues.
Yeah.
And also the fact that Steph seems back. You know, he looked right. He was doing his, you know, crazy pirouettes around the perimeter. You know, he was, you know, back to being in the zone, and that wasn't something we could say 2 weeks ago. So I think, you know, Golden State, it really comes down to game one. If Golden State wins game one, I think they win the series. If Cleveland can steal game one, then I give them a shot.
Oh, here we go. I'm excited. I'm actually excited for a night off or two before things really get started. But it should be a lot of fun. I think it'll be a great series. And even if it's not a great series, it's the coronation of a killer Warriors team, which is also fantastic, because after the past week or two, I have a whole new respect for that team, and it will be cool to see them finish this season with a title. So what do you think? Should we do a recap podcast on Friday afternoon?
Why not? Let's do it. And I think just from a history standpoint, you know, LeBron answers every critic if he wins this finals. You know, I think people, the nitpicking at his finals record goes by the wayside if he gets one in Cleveland.
Why I like him. Feels right. It feels like we're due.
It would be on his terms. I mean, there would be nothing else you could take away from him. I think it would kind of vault him also into, you know, the top three or four players of all time conversation, like right now at this point. So I think that would be huge for him. On the other side, you look at the 73 wins validation that keeps them in the best team of all time conversation. If they win, Steph gets two titles, two MVPs. So now he's probably above a guy like Isaiah Thomas on the best point guards of all time list. So yeah, you've got some, you know, you got some pretty big stakes here. Not to mention, you know, rematches between superstars and whose league is this, Steph's or LeBron's. I mean, there's a lot going on in this series.
Yeah. Yeah. It's going to be great. And in either one of these teams, if either one of these teams wins the title, I mean, they're both deserving, which is not true of a lot of years in the finals, but we've gotten lucky the past few years. All right, man. Well, we'll wrap it up here. I will talk to you Friday and we'll just go from there. I can't wait to see how much of this podcast looks completely wrong after game one.
All right. Well, steer clear of airplane lavatories and have a good week.
All right, man. Take it easy.
Thanks for tuning in for another episode of Open Floor. You can follow Andrew Sharp on Twitter at Andrew Sharp and Ben Golliver at Ben Golliver. Please subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, or your podcast app of choice. And you can hear the whole SI network at si.com/podcasts.
Another great edition of Open Floor is in the books. Did you know Locked On has a daily podcast for all 30 NBA teams? If you're a Lakers fan, search Locked On Lakers. A Celtics fan, search Locked On Celtics. Warriors fans, search Locked On Warriors. Yes, all 30 NBA teams have a daily bite-sized podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team.
It's the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.